Hey, it's Yardley.
And Dan.
And Dave.
I know, we know. We're interrupting your episode. Don't panic. We hate that too.
But it's for a good reason. If you're deep in our back catalog, listening to older episodes, you sound like one of our super fans.
Which means you might want to take things a step further and join our super fam.
Because super fam members get every new episode of Small Town Dicks early and ad-free.
Plus, bonus content every single week, all year round, even between seasons.
Think deeper dives into the topics we touch on in the show. Extra cases.
It's basically like hanging out with us between episodes and between seasons. Also, it is the best way to support our team behind the scenes so we can keep bringing you the stories that you love.
And yes, there's a super fam community. And yes, there are enamel pins and tote bags.
That's right. We've got you covered.
Super fam, the tote bags, they're so cute. If you're ready to go deeper with Small Town Dicks, all you have to do is visit smalltowndicks.com/superfam. That's SUPERFAM. We can't wait to see you there. Hey, Small Town Fam. It's Yardley. How are you guys? I hope you're all well. We have such an interesting case for you today. It involves a murder in a homeless encampment. And our guest today, Deputy Brandon, gives a fascinating account of the challenges that come with investigating a crime like that when the people you want to talk to are constantly on the move. And as a rule, don't talk to the police about anything. As details of the victim in this case emerge, it's clear that life in this traveling community is dangerous and unpredictable, and alliances change on a dime. So when Brandon and his team actually start interviewing witnesses, it's hard to know who's telling the truth and who just has a beef with their neighbor and wants to put them in a bad spot. And then there are the pentagrams, a bit of Wicca, and a Bible that, well, you'll see. Let's just say, sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction. Here is Bedeviled. Hi there, I'm Yardley.
I'm Dan.
I'm Dave.
And I'm Paul.
And this is Small Town Dicks.
Dave and I are identical twins
and retired detectives from Small Town USA.
And I'm a veteran cold case investigator who helped catch the Golden State Killer using a revolutionary DNA tool.
Between the three of us, we've investigated thousands of crimes, from petty theft to sexual assault, child abuse to murder.
Each case we cover is told by the detective who investigated it, offering a rare, personal account of how they solved the crime.
Names, places, and certain details have been changed to protect the privacy of victims and their families.
And although we're aware that some of our listeners may be familiar with these cases, we ask you to please join us in continuing to protect the true identities of those involved
out of respect for what they've been through.
Thank you.
Today on Small Town Dicks, we have the usual suspects, and that includes Detective Dan.
Hello, team.
Hello, hello. We have Detective Dave.
Hello, team.
Good one, Dave.
Team's all here.
I froze.
Twins.
I froze. I got caught between my hey and my hello and hey there. Whatever.
It's funny because that's probably one of the cleanest, least embellished intros I've done in so many months. Anywho, and let us not forget the one and only incredible, the iconic Paul Holes.
Hello, team.
There's something in the water.
Solidarity.
That's right.
Solidarity. I like it. We stick together. And Small Town Fam, we are so pleased to welcome a new guest to the podcast today, Deputy Brandon.
Hello.
Hello, Brandon. Thank you so much for being with us and for giving up one of your very precious days off.
Well, thanks for having me.
And it's good to see this guy, Brandon.
I was going to say, we're so thrilled to have you. And Brandon, before we get started on the case you brought for us today, you have an inside connection to this team. Tell us about that, Dave and Brandon.
Yeah, I went to the police academy with Dave about 16, 17 years ago.
It was a millennia.
We were in the same class, and out of everybody in the class, there's like a group of us that kind of hung out, and me and Dave kind of stayed in touch on and off throughout our careers, and we helped each other out with a couple cases here and there.
On a couple of occasions, I've been able to reach out when I was still working cases. Hey, Brandon, you're 3 hours south of where I live. Can you save me a 6-hour round trip drive just to check an address? And he'd go out and check an address for a vehicle, help me take at least 2 people into custody over the years, which I greatly appreciate. And I think you felt anytime you wanted to call to our agency, you felt like you could get the same type of assistance.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's good to have those contacts. You could reach out and know that you're going to get somebody that's going to go the extra mile to help you.
So Brandon's municipal department was very similar to the department that Dan and I worked in as far as like population, territory, size, the demographic type things. But Brandon has since moved on to a different type of work, which is with the sheriff's office. So Brandon, can you kind of tell us, walk us through post-academy, how you got into police work and kind of your career path?
Yeah, I started out with the Klamath Falls Police Department. I was hired in 07 and I was on patrol for 4 years and I wanted to do the SWAT team. So I got on with the SWAT team a couple years after I started. I think in 2010 is when I got on the SWAT team. I also got to do like a firearms instructor, taser instructor, and I really wanted to get investigations. I found solving burglaries on the patrol level and taking a deeper dive into cases was kind of my niche. So I ended up getting on with the street crimes unit in 2011. Did that for 2 years. That was a blast. I had a partner. His name's Jack Daniel. And he's a good dude. So he was one of my best friends. And to be able to have that kind of job where you're working plain clothes, unmarked cars, it was awesome. Probably my favorite time of my career. And then went into criminal detectives. I wanted more opportunity for my family, for job progression and stuff. So ended up going to Medford PD in 2014. You know, I kind of got a little country bumpkin in me. And it was time to move on to the woods and get on with the county. So I love it. I see elk all the time and it's really good. And I have a lot of friends at the sheriff's office, which was pretty easy to be persuaded to go over there.
Amazing. So Brandon, why don't you tell us, please, how this case came to you?
So it was in March of 2021. I was working as a detective at Medford Police Department. I was working on a police report, and one of the patrol sergeants went into the lieutenant in charge of the detective division. And I could hear her talking about how patrol ended up discovering a body that they were called to on the Greenway. So I kind of want to break this down and kind of explain what the Greenway is. There's this creek that runs through, kind of parallels a lot of I-5 as it comes down. There's some parks and stuff. And it's like 15 to 20 miles worth of bike paths along the creek. It's a nice area, but prior to COVID, there was a lot of homeless camps and different places throughout the Greenway. And when you go down to the Greenway too, there's a lot of drug addicted people. I'd say 98% of those people are on fentanyl, meth, heroin, whatever, you know. Just a real violent environment. During this time, we started a livability team with their focus on the homeless. They did things where, like, to try to keep the Greenway and that portion usable for the public, they would say, hey, this camp, this has to be cleaned up within a certain amount of time. It's like 72 hours. And then the city also has to provide an alternative place for them to live. So you get a lot of these city-ran street camps, you know, and stuff that are where the people that you're trying to move along off the Greenway can have an option to go stay. So I'll just back up into the month prior, February of 2021, a guy got shot in his head in his camp, murdered there. So we did the investigation with that, which really helped this call.
So this guy got shot in the head on the Greenway before the case you're going to talk about today.
Yes, it was about 200 yards from the call that I'm going to talk about. So that's the Greenway, just so the listeners understand the environment that we're working in. So going back to the case, I go talk to the lieutenant and the sergeant, find out that, yeah, there is indeed a potential body buried in a shallow grave on the Greenway. There's a couple of detectives in the office typing. So I went and grabbed him and said, hey, let's go down to the Greenway and see what we got. So pulled up to the spot and had to hike down towards the creek. There's a small hillside, probably about 5 feet high in elevation from the rest of the ground. And there's four big logs stacked up on the edge of this hillside. And so one of the patrol officers took me down to that spot and said, it's right here. So he kind of had to get up on the logs and look down in through the logs. And the first thing I noticed was a smell. It was just heavy decomp smell of just death. Rather, it's a deer on the side of the road that you smell, or a dog or a human. They all smell the same, and it's different from like raw sewage or any kind of other putrid smells that you might smell.
What's the purpose of the logs?
We didn't know at the time. There's a lot of trees and stuff, and these people that are homeless, sometimes they'll cut down bushes and trees and actually make their camps in the foliage and stuff and just kind of use it to block wind. Sometimes you see that, and they're burning the trees all the time. So you go down there and there's always cut up trees and foliage and stuff. But the way the logs were set up, it was kind of like it was almost over, like covering the grave. And the only thing I could see sticking out was just a few inches of like blue jeans kind of sticking up. And then what I recognize as decomp flesh around it, it was all white and black and just kind of...
Marbled.
Yeah, marbled. Yeah, that's a great word.
Wait, what was marbled?
This term marbling, you know, that's where the blood that is still in the veins, it putrefies. And so now instead of being the normal color underneath the skin, the veins start to stand out and take on almost a blackish look. And so you have this very pale flesh with these greenish black veins running through it. And so when I hear the term marbling, that's what I visualize. Now, what Brandon's talking about could be marbling coupled with you have exposed flesh to the environment. And typically with a buried body, if it's not being directly hit with the sun, the flesh underneath is a little bit more preserved, but the flesh that's exposed to the environment, exposed to the sun, desiccates, it dries out. And now you get this brownish orange kind of look. And in digging up a body out of a shallow grave, and I'm not going to, you know, step on Brandon's story at all, paying attention to the decomposition and how different parts of the body appear becomes important in terms of reconstructing what the victim has been through after death.
Yeah, and that's perfect as far as the description. It was in the shade under the trees, and it was probably only about the size of a 50-cent piece that I could see of it.
Did you know what part of the body you were looking at?
No, not at all, because it was completely under the ground. Just like I said, a few inches of what looked like blue jean fabric, and right next to that was the marble decomposed flesh. A few feet down from that, there was the heel of a shoe sticking up, and it was only exposed by maybe an inch or two, but you can make out the red and white portion of the heel. And looking at that compared to where I saw the blue jeans and a little bit of decomposed flesh, it looked like under the ground he was face down. So at that point, we have state police. They respond to all of our murder investigations for forensics on scene. So the forensics team showed up. We pulled up a map and did like a radius around where the crime scene was at and asked them, hey, we need to identify every camp and every person that's in this area right now. The good thing was that murder that happened a month prior, we'd done the same thing. And so we had known everybody that was in those locations and who was around that area. So that helped us out a lot to be able to compare, because a lot of these people move up and down the Greenway and out of town, and they travel a lot.
When you say you'd interviewed all these people who were part of these camps in the murder that happened a month before, was it relatively the same cast of characters for this murder that you'd walked up on?
Yeah, there's a lot of people that were still there in those same spots during that month, which was really good for this case. But when you start talking to some of these people in that area, you know, they say, hey, there's this guy from Seattle that was here like 3 days ago, and we haven't seen him since. He was here for like a week. Well, as an investigator, you're thinking, oh, we got a traveler from another city coming down, and now he's gone. We need to identify that person. That becomes a challenge when you're dealing with people that don't have homes. They don't have jobs and places you can contact them and vehicles associated with them and stuff, things that we would use to identify people. They don't have that.
They're hard to track down. You're really dependent on when does this person you're looking for have their next contact with police and have their name run officially. And then you as the detective have already put out a flag on someone, a bolo. Hey, I'm looking for this person. I need to talk to him. Call me day or night if you come across this person. So you really depend on patrol guys for that stuff.
And bolo is be on the lookout?
Yes.
So this canvassing that you're doing, you're filling out FI cards, field interview cards on everyone, like blue and gray tent as part of the notes. Like, this is how we can identify which tent this person lives in, and do they have a dog? What kind of dog do they have? You try to identify a certain spot, like toward the south end of the greenway. I mean, those are the kind of notes that you're taking on a field interview card. And you log that into your database, and the better information you put into the database, the better information you're going to have to go back on. And that's why it's important the month before you're making headway doing your canvas, and now you've got kind of a base of information.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So while they're doing that, the crime lab shows up and we start removing the logs off the hillside, and we laid out a tarp, had the sifting cage. It's a screen that allows small dirt to fall through, but will catch everything else. And one handful at a time, the crime lab tech would pick that up, put it onto the sifter, and we'd sift through it, because we don't know how this person died. We don't know if he was shot, if he was stabbed. We don't know if he was in a fight and a fingernail from the suspect got torn off and is now on the ground. You know, there's such small evidence that can be obtained from that scene.
Brandon, do you have any idea how long this person has been dead?
Not at this time, we didn't, no. Once the dirt started getting removed from and you start seeing a lot more condition of the body with the decomposition, you could tell it had been in the ground for, I was thinking, at least a month probably. So once we get all the dirt removed from him, he's face down. One of his hands was curled up under his chest, which was really good because the other hand was out flat, and that hand was completely decomposed, the one that was flat. The one that was tucked up under him actually preserved part of his ridge line and his fingerprints, which was really good for us. He was partially wrapped in a blue and green tarp, and we got some small things of evidence out of there, but nothing substantial.
Could you tell how he died?
At that time, we didn't know what caused his death, except for the back of his head. He had a hole about the size of a softball in the back of his head. And since he was face down, that's one of the first things we've seen. But when you're dealing with a body like that, you can't assume that's what caused his death, because he could have been strangled and then struck after he died. You know, there's a lot of things that could have led up to the cause of death. There could be a lot more injuries on the body that we don't know at that time. He was clothed. He had a couple sweatshirts on, layers of sweatshirts, which is pretty common for people down there in that time. So when we remove him, we don't know who he is. We don't have him identified. We take him to the morgue where there will be an autopsy done on him. So at that point, it was getting dark out. And I made the decision at that point, hey, we don't know who we're dealing with yet as far as our victim and having him identified. There's not much more we can do at this point. The autopsy was scheduled for, I think, 2 days later, right? So the case is just kind of cold right now. We're just going to put it on hold until we can get him identified.
When you do the canvas of the various tents around, nobody says, oh, my friend is missing. Like, none of the people in those camps offer any information that's usable for you at this time.
Correct. There is no information that anybody's giving us. And one of the things that was odd about this was, while we were waiting for the crime lab to arrive on scene, there's a camp probably about 30 to 50 yards from where the location of the body was discovered. And there's like not a lot of bushes and things that would conceal it. It's almost a straight shot to the crime scene from this camp. So I go over there. There's a couple tents there. There's only one person there, and she identifies herself as Feathers. And I'm like, hey, who lives in this camp? And she's like, just me and my boyfriend, Rich. And I was like, okay. So I'm talking to her for a few minutes. I'm like, you know anything about a body that might be over there? She's like, nope, I don't know anything about that.
She didn't smell the body?
Honestly, from that point where it was buried, you had to get kind of close to the actual scene to smell it. So the ground actually kept a lot of the smell pretty contained. And you'd have to probably get within 5-10 feet from the actual shallow gravesite to smell it. So what happened was, Feathers didn't give us any information. We got her identified with her real name. And, you know, when you talk to these people, they're like, oh, it's my boyfriend, Rich. Well, what's Rich's last name? I don't know. They give you no information whatsoever.
There's such a transactional nature of relationships among the unhoused population that it's like two ships in the night, and you run into somebody in a different city, you know, 50 miles away years later, and you haven't seen them since your last stop in whatever city. So you have that issue as a challenge, and then you have the other issue, which is you don't talk when you're on the streets, especially if it's the cops asking questions around homeless and transient camps and they're asking about murder. That's the last time you want to be really forthcoming with information. So it's all about relationships between law enforcement and potential witnesses in that area. And it comes down to, how do your patrol guys treat folks along the Greenway? It's going to come down to relationships.
Absolutely.
In your conversation with Feathers, is she setting off any alarms for you?
Well, yeah, just the location of their camp. She said she'd lived there for a couple months, hasn't moved. I would think that if somebody was being buried and logs being stacked over within eyesight from your camp, you would have seen something, right? And the fact that she said she's been there for a substantial time and hasn't seen anything, had zero information, it was very concerning. And that's what's hard about these cases when, one, you don't know who your victim is, but two, you talk to another guy in there and he starts talking about a guy from Seattle that just passed through and is now gone. You're like, okay, that could be my guy. And I talked to Feathers. I'm like, okay, she could be potentially involved in this. Then I talked to this other guy, Jesse, that was down there. He was within close proximity, but you couldn't see the gravesite from his camp. He was more down by the river. Jesse says, that camp, and points towards Feathers' camp. He goes, this girl Feathers lives there with her boyfriend, Rich, and they scream and yell all the time, and Rich is crazy. He carries around sharpened sticks all the time. He seems real violent. Jesse said his camp was closer to Feather and Rich's camp a few weeks prior, but because they were causing so many issues and so hostile towards each other, he became worried about his safety being within close proximity, so he moved his camp down the river a little bit further from them. It kind of confirms, you know, you have a propensity of violence, but then at the same time, you're thinking, like, my thought was, if they did kill this person and bury him at their camp, you know, kind of like, don't shit in your own backyard, you know?
Do you really bury a body 50 to 100 yards from your camp and not think maybe we should pick up the stakes and move a little bit?
Yeah. So, you know, early on, everybody you talk to, you have red flags. Am I talking to a potential involved person or suspect right here, you know? But at that time, you're so early in the investigation. When you have somebody that has just been shot, maybe on a drive-by shooting or something, and they're on the ground, you got to run with that case and develop as many leads as possible on the front end. With this case, it's a little different because it's cold. You could actually take your time to develop things a little bit better where you don't have to run, you know, like within that first 48 hours where it's really important. We could kind of take our time with this one a little bit.
Could you tell what kind of tool may have been used to dig the shallow grave?
No. The problem was the hole itself was just deep enough for the body with a couple inches of dirt layered over the top of the body. So it was very shallow, and we'd had a lot of rain and weather and stuff coming in during that time, which erodes the dirt. And that's probably why it took a month for somebody to come by and find it, because it was just a small area that showed exposure. You know, it was probably from the rain washing away the top layer of dirt and stuff. So one more thing that was interesting about this guy, Jesse, who tells me that Feathers and Rich camp is violent and they're always screaming at each other. When we first started moving the logs off the shallow grave, Jesse comes and he's watching and he's flagging me over to come and talk to him. So I go talk to Jesse and he said, hey, I just want to let you know there was a lot of logs stacked on that pile a few days ago. And he said, I started taking logs off that back to my camp to build a wall. And what he told me was when he starts getting down lower after several logs, he starts smelling sewage. And he thought people were sitting on the logs and using the ground as a bathroom. So he quit taking logs off it. Well, as soon as he told me that, he was very cooperative on the front end too. And that's another thing as an investigator, when you start learning human behavior and the way people respond to guilt and fear, they will either give you no information or they will be overly excited to help you and overly happy that your presence is there and too helpful. And that's kind of a vibe I was getting from Jesse in my first statement. I was like, that guy is too nice.
Right. Like, this is too easy right now.
Yeah. Now Jesse is putting himself at the scene. Like, hey, I moved those logs just to let you know. I smelt sewage. And it's like, no, that's not sewage, you know?
Right. And it is. It's a completely different smell.
Yeah. So I'm like, well, let's walk down and see your wall that you built with these logs. He had a great camp, man. He had like a hinge gate to go in and beautiful spot down on the river. So I felt a little more relieved to see, okay, he does have evidence that's showing his statement, but still weird that he was at that scene.
Right. And overly helpful.
Yeah. So moving on to the autopsy, I'll just kind of real briefly go over the injuries. We pulled out a small BB from like a BB gun out of his eye, and it had like little divots in the BB itself. looked old. It did not look fresh at all. This person had broken bones in his face, around his nose, and above his mouth. His jaw was broken in three places. He had a large hole in the back of the skull that we already knew. He had a broken hyoid bone and a broken neck. And so, obviously, when you have those two injuries with a broken neck, broken hyoid bone, it's indicative of strangulation. So this guy had a lot of injuries. We still didn't know who he was. He had such decomp that he was unrecognizable. So one of the things that we did was his hand was curled up under his chest, and there's just enough ridge line. So we removed the skin off the finger, and one of our people that was with us put his finger inside the skin of the finger. So he's wearing the skin, and then fingerprinted himself. And we were able to get a positive ID on that. And he was identified as this male named Aaron.
Hey, it's Yardley.
And Dan.
And Dave.
I know, we know. We're interrupting your episode. Don't panic. We hate that too.
But it's for a good reason. If you're deep in our back catalog, listening to older episodes, you sound like one of our super fans.
Which means you might want to take things a step further and join our super fam.
Because super fam members get every new episode of Small Town Dicks early and ad-free.
Plus, bonus content every single week, all year round, even between seasons.
Think deeper dives into the topics we touch on in the show. Extra cases.
It's basically like hanging out with us between episodes and between seasons. Also, it is the best way to support our team behind the scenes so we can keep bringing you the stories that you love.
And yes, there's a super fam community. And yes, there are enamel pins and tote bags.
That's right. We've got you covered.
Super fam, the tote bags, they're so cute. If you're ready to go deeper with Small Town Dicks, all you have to do is visit smalltowndicks.com/superfam. That's SUPERFAM. We can't wait to see you there.
Tell us about Aaron.
Well, Aaron had a rough life. He was drug addicted and living on the Greenway. And he actually had family in the general area of our community. And they have tried helping him a lot throughout his life. And that's the path that he chose, was to live on the Greenway and do that lifestyle down there. Really sad when we talked to his family. Aaron was deaf in one ear, fully deaf, and lost a lot of hearing in his other ear. So one of the things he did is he read lips. That's one of the things that he really was dependent on. We found a 2019 report out of Medford where he had been shot in his eye with a BB gun. And so you think about this guy that's living in a really violent area of town, and these people are not nice to each other. They're stealing and hurting each other all the time. And he's almost deaf completely, relies on lip reading, and he gets assaulted 2 years prior, gets shot in his eye. Now, you know, one of his five senses is gone, and then 50% of the next sense he has for vision is gone. And he didn't get medical help. He was blind in that eye and lived for another 2 years with a BB in his eye. That just made me feel really sad for him.
That's unbelievable. How old was Aaron when he died?
He was roughly, I think, in his mid-30s.
And did you get any indication that Aaron's out there looking for trouble, or does he kind of say to himself?
You know, he was also a small-statured male, skinny, short. And when you live in those rough cultures, it's almost like Lord of the Flies, you know, where it's just chaos in that environment. Size helps you. If you're smaller, you're on the bottom of the pecking order, unless you're very violent. So I would imagine Aaron had a rough life on the Greenway. And that just kind of makes you sad to see how these people live. Nobody wakes up every day that's addicted to drugs and is excited that they are looking for a bag of dope. And that's the first thing they're thinking of when they wake up, the last thing they think of when they go to bed. Even the drug addicted people don't want to live like that. It's really sad. You know, it's a sad lifestyle and everything that goes along with it. Once we get Aaron identified, we all get together with our detective vision and command post and start handing out assignments. It is so important to know who you're dealing with, because now we can go back to these camps and say, hey, do you know Aaron? And they say, yeah, I know Aaron. When's the last time you seen him? Who does he hang out with? His family didn't have a lot of information of who he hung out with. So it's going to be the people on the greenway that are going to have the most information. And we could now hit the ground running fast and hard trying to get this solved. What happens is I split up our detectives into different teams. You don't want one detective going down into these camps by themselves, you know, in case they get in something. So we did teams of two and three. And my main focus was, now we got to go to Feather's camp. I want to go back to Jesse and really start putting some pressure on him. And there's a lot of other behind the scenes things, like we got to find out when the last time Aaron was seen alive. So we start hitting up, you know, our St. Vincent de Paul. They give food and resources to the homeless. And so we're sending detectives down there to see when Aaron was last there. So there's a lot of different avenues trying to reach out to family and stuff. But those were my main focus on the greenway, was those camps. So what happens is, I'm in the command post. I get a call from a detective that interviews this guy, Corey, that lives across the path on the other side of where the gravesite was found. And this detective gets information from Corey that he heard that Rich, which is Feather's boyfriend, had told Feathers that he killed Aaron, and that this information got passed down to a few people. So another thing when you're working these cases with the homeless population is rumor mill is out of control. You know, it gets really
convoluted.
Yes, very quickly. But that's the first lead that came in. The other thing that Corey said that was pretty credible that I liked was, a few days after he had heard that, he sees Rich at Aaron's camp breaking down his tent, selling his bike, selling his stuff to other people. And Corey asked Rich, where's Aaron? And Rich tells Corey, oh, he moved to Washington. And so, you know, when I hear that, that's firsthand information. I like the path that we're going down with this. So we end up getting some detectives at Feather's camp, and Rich is there. Rich has a misdemeanor warrant for trespass, which we love to have people with warrants when we need to talk to them. He is carrying this big sharpened stick. He is growling and yelling and walking through trees and screaming, yelling, hitting sticks on the trees. And they need to take him into custody. So they're asking for other units to get there. He's not listening to commands to stop. He's just walking through all the trees and gets on the path and just keeps walking away with a line of cop cars behind him, trying to safely take him into custody.
So it's like the slow roll containment?
Yes. Yeah. And it doesn't go very far, you know, maybe 30 yards, 40 yards. Then they get Rich in custody. They start transporting him down to the police department for an interview.
So, Brandon, you have Rich in custody, and I'm guessing you now want to search the camp where he and Feathers live. Do you need their consent or a warrant to do that?
I can answer that. Yes, you need their consent or you need a search warrant. They do have a right to privacy in their camp, and I think the courts have ruled on this in the past about, even though their tent may be on public property, like city property, the courts have ruled that these homeless encampments, that they still have a right to privacy. So the police can't just go in there and grab their stuff and throw it away.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. When I walk into Feather's camp, one thing that I noticed was there's a couple trees real close to her tent, and they have red pentagrams painted on them. And a pentagram is the five-star pointed star at the circle around it. It's a symbol for the occult, right? Which isn't uncommon to see that stuff down there. But there's several things like that there. There's a big 55-gallon steel burn barrel directly in front of her tent that is filled to the brim with ashes and black soot and stuff and miscellaneous items that had been burned in there. And Feathers is sitting on a log. And so I talked to one of the detectives. I had a talk with her, and she really wasn't giving up much information, but she did admit that she knew Aaron to this other detective. And she told that detective that Aaron had been staying at her camp, kind of bouncing between her camp and his camp, which my first contact with her on the day that the body was found, she said, it's me and Rich that live here, and left out the information that Aaron frequents there and hangs out there, right? So I sat down next to her and I started talking to her. She also had a misdemeanor warrant. So we're talking. The approach I took with her wasn't, hey, you lied to me. It was a very compassionate, hey, I'm sorry you lost your friend. And with her, when she started crying, I knew I was going to get like good cooperation. She was crying out of sorrow and sadness. And that interview went really well with her. Feathers told me that Rich kept coming up to her a couple months prior and was complaining that Rich believed Aaron was trying to have sex with him. And then a couple days later, Rich believed that Aaron was trying to rape him while he was sleeping, rape Rich. Feather said that Rich was really upset. And the last time that she saw Aaron was Rich and Aaron were standing next to each other by the burn barrel. And then they began walking off in the direction towards the hillside where the logs were. And a few minutes later, Rich came alone back to the camp and he told her Aaron went on a walk that he was never going to come back from. Feathers told me that Rich was holding an axe while he said this and that Rich tried making her lick the blood off the axe blade. And she said, I absolutely did not want to lick that. I wasn't going to do it. And she began to argue with Rich while he was telling her this and trying to make her lick the axe. And Feathers told me that Rich said he hit Aaron in the back of the head. Well, the only people that knew that he had a hole in the back of his head was the person who did it and the investigators, right? We had not given her that information at all. Feathers said that after they talked about this for a few minutes, Rich grabbed a shovel and walked back towards the direction. It was at night. She couldn't see where he went because it was dark out, but he left with the shovel. And then a couple days later, Feathers said that Rich kept trying to get her to go look at Aaron's body. And she said, I don't want to see it. Feathers told me she had a picture of Aaron that she put up in her tent. She showed me, you walk in and it's like set up like somebody would hang a framed picture on their wall, but it was on their tent. She said she put that up the day that Rich told her Aaron went on a walk that he wasn't coming back from.
Like as a memorial.
Yes. This is the problem though. Feathers told us a lot of other things. Like this is the eighth person Rich killed this month. Rich stabbed a guy in the neck, gave us the date of when it happened, gave us the name of the guy, said she thinks Rich might have buried him too. Well, we knew we just had police contact with that guy like within that 24 hour prior to that.
So police had just spoken to this guy that Feather says Rich also killed and buried.
Yes. So we go talk to him and he has no injury on his neck. He's like, yeah, Rich and I got in an argument, but he didn't stab me. So that becomes a problem. I like the information Feathers give me that matches the physical evidence we have, but how credible is she? You know, and that's a hard time when you're doing people on drugs all the time is their brains aren't working with time frames and facts.
And a defense attorney at trial is going to have a field day with the inconsistencies and tell the jury, ignore everything they can corroborate and accept everything that we have proven as false or inconsistent. And it's tough sledding.
Absolutely. It's not good for the case.
Yeah.
So what happens, though, is during that day, detectives talk to a lot of people down on the Greenway, and everybody has a nickname. So when you talk to these people, they're mentioning these names as if they're a first name basis. We talked to Pickles, and Pickles gave us information that she heard from Feathers that Rich killed Aaron. We talked to Red and Saint, and they confirm, along with Corey's statement, that, yeah, we saw Rich taking apart Aaron's camp a couple weeks ago, and Saint's like, I got Aaron's bike, I bought it, you know? So at least now we start getting a little bit more people identified that are working with us and cooperative with us at this point and are willing to talk. So one of the things we did before we left is we locked down the camp, and really that whole crime scene had been locked down since the discovery of the body. But the camp itself of Feathers and Rich, we can't lock that scene down prior to having this information. Now we have this information, we're going to lock it down, make sure that any kind of evidence that might be in there stays there until we're ready to do a search warrant on their property.
So Brandon, Rich has been arrested and he's in custody. Do you arrest Feathers on her warrant as well?
Yes. So they were arrested on their warrants. So they go back to the police station for more formal interviews. I go to the police department and I'm watching the interview with Rich. The detectives are interviewing him. And if you're in law enforcement, you know those people that you are talking to that are real volatile, really angry. You're looking at the way they're talking, the things they're saying, like, I'm going to pull your intestines out and decorate this room with your intestines. Probably look at that as a guy that has propensity of violence.
This is Rich?
Yeah, it is Rich saying this.
I would say with all the statements back at the Greenway, like circumstantially, it doesn't look great for Rich.
No, it doesn't. And especially when he's really making violent, crazy statements like that. And he had the deepest voice and he would growl when he talked and really aggressive, loud, strong voice on top of the growling and the deepness. It was really bizarre.
Literally growl like an animal?
Yeah. They would ask him a question. He would start growling.
How big is Rich and is he all tatted up? Does he have any specific tattoos that stand out?
You know, I can't remember if he had tattoos, but he's, I believe, over 6 foot. He was a tall guy, and he appeared to be kind of lanky, longer arms, thin. He wasn't like obese or anything like that. He was a thin, lanky, wiry guy. So basically in that interview, the only information that we get interviewing Rich is he talks about how Feathers and him are dating and Feathers a witch into Wicca and stuff like that. He said he had been marked by God, allowing him to know Lucifer. He would say things like, I had to do what I was told or I'll get raped by men. He told the detectives that last time he saw Aaron was making sexual advances towards him. Rich also said he's an infomaniac and sex is medicine. But during the interview, he expressed in very vulgar language a deep hatred towards homosexuality and had a deep anger against that. So that was all the information we got. He denied repeatedly any involvement in the murder of Aaron, the knowledge of who did it, just denied nonstop. And the thing that was hard about that is Rich says crazy things like, I'm marked by God to know Lucifer. But at the same time, he would say things that are so articulate. Every time you ask him a question, he would respond appropriately. You know, he's not just sitting there being crazy. He can express himself well, and he is pretty smart. You know, you get those guys that you talk to where you can see a level of intelligence too. He had that. And so, you know, he wasn't just this drug-induced guy that's in there having hallucinations.
So you're witnessing this interview with Rich, and I imagine the first thing that's going through your mind is, there's going to be a mental defense and we have to defeat this mental defense.
Right.
How the crime is actually accomplished gives great insight into the offender's state of mind at the time of the crime. You know, so the way he committed the crime, it does not add up to Rich being the psychotic, disorganized offender. He walks Aaron away to isolate the victim, kills Aaron, assuming what Feathers is saying is right, and then takes the time to hide the body. This is showing Rich is aware. At the time the crime is committed, he is thinking in the right state of mind. He knows right from wrong.
Yeah, and now you've got Rich dismantling Aaron's tent, getting rid of Aaron's property.
Saying he moved to Washington.
Yeah, he went on a walk that he's never coming back from.
Right.
There's a lot to this. Rich has some splaining to do.
Oh, he explains a lot later on. It's wild.
Hey, it's Yardley.
And Dan.
And Dave.
I know, we know. We're interrupting your episode. Don't panic. We hate that too.
But it's for a good reason. If you're deep in our back catalog, listening to older episodes, you sound like one of our super fans.
Which means you might want to take things a step further and join our super fam.
Because super fam members get every new episode of Small Town Dicks early and ad-free.
Plus, bonus content every single week. All year round, even between seasons.
Think deeper dives into the topics we touch on in the show. Extra cases.
It's basically like hanging out with us between episodes and between seasons. Also, it is the best way to support our team behind the scenes so we can keep bringing you the stories that you love.
And yes, there's a super fam community. And yes, there are enamel pins and tote bags.
That's right. We've got you covered.
Super fam, the tote bags, they're so cute. If you're ready to go deeper with Small Town Dicks, all you have to do is visit smalltowndicks.com/superfam. That's SUPERFAM. We can't wait to see you there.
So, we really don't get anywhere with Rich that day for a lot of things that would help us charge him with the murder for his own statements, right? He might have some motive stuff in there with the rape and the trying to make sexual advances and his pure hatred towards homosexual acts. That's one of those things where, yeah, that might line up with motive, but that doesn't mean Rich killed Aaron, right? Just based on that statement. So the couple things we got from Feathers during the interview with her at the station was that when Rich was holding the axe, Feathers saw him burn the axe, which she described it as a yellow axe handle, right? And he had burnt it at their camp, which we all know the iron's not going to burn on the metal portion of the axe, you know, so that's good. And you're talking about hours at the station with these interviews. We're now into the evening hours, and Rich is going to go to jail for his warrant. So he hit a point where he became really hostile in the interview room and is screaming. He had to be secured again in handcuffs because he was getting out of control, making threats to blow up the department, kill everybody, you know, all this stuff. And when they put him back in the car to take him to jail, the patrol car on his way to jail, Rich had self-harm hitting his face in the cage, you know, and banging and stuff. So that had to be addressed on the way to jail. He just was completely out of control.
Brandon, how old are Rich and Feathers, roughly?
They're in their 30s, 30s and 40s. Everybody in this is, you know, mid-30s up to mid-40s.
Got it.
So we get the warrant signed because while these interviews are going on, other detectives are working on the warrants for the camp. And, you know, there's still a lot of moving parts going on. So we decide to just hold on to the crime scene of Feathers Camp where the body was. We have officers out there through the night and we're going to serve it the next morning in daylight. This is my favorite part of the story. We get there in the morning. There's like four or five detectives, myself, Detective Ford, Detective Newell, a couple of good solid people that are there. My boss, Sergeant Parks, is there. So we take our scene pictures, you know, and stuff, and we're getting ready to dump this barrel out. We have a big tarp set up so that when we dump it, it's on clean ground, and then we could sift through everything and see what evidence might be in there.
And this is the barrel that was outside Feathers and Rich's tent?
Yeah, it was about probably 20 feet from their front door of their tent. We get this burn barrel and it has like maybe a couple inches from the top that's not filled up with ash. And you could see like burnt soup can, you know, any metal springs kind of sticking up just where they were burning all these miscellaneous things. And we dump it down on this tarp. And as we're pulling it out, there's close to 55 gallons of ash and debris, right? Everything is black charcoal. Everything is burnt to a crisp. Any kind of paper is now just ash, soot. And in the middle of this, a holy Bible falls out on the tarp from the barrel. And everyone's like, whoa, like this thing is not even burnt, right? This thing is in mint condition. You know, like when paper gets hot by fire, gets a flame next, it'll start turning yellow and singeing, you know? There's none of that on this Bible. There's not a wrinkled page on it. It is in pristine condition. There was not one trace of other paper that was not burnt. Everything was burnt except for this Bible.
You wouldn't expect to see a Bible where there's a pentagram scribbled on a tree in red paint, you know, a couple yards away.
From a camp where Rich is saying Feathers is a witch and I communicate with Lucifer.
And I guess a burn barrel is exactly where you would expect to find a Bible in that camp.
Right. For me, that was absolutely incredible.
I got chills, dude.
I pick it up and I'm looking at it and I'm going through every page like there's nothing burnt. These pages aren't even wrinkled, you know? It looked like the Bible on my hotel nightstand last night. It was in that kind of condition, right? So I go to Sergeant Parks and I show him the Bible. I'm like, you're not going to believe this, dude. Look at this. And you're lying that you put that there. That didn't happen. You're playing a joke. So he comes walking up and all the other detectives are like, this really happened. You know, they're explaining it to him and I'm still holding the Bible. And he goes, quit touching that. I'm getting out of here. He's like, you want nothing to do with that.
What's this wizardry going on around here?
Yeah. So outside of that, we didn't find any evidence in that trash can. We couldn't find the axe. The way that Feathers described it, it's either a painted wood axe handle that was painted yellow or it's plastic. There's no sign of anything in there, not the axe head.
You have no indication this Bible belonged to Aaron.
No. And then this is the thing about these camps, too, is, yeah, it might be their camp, Feathers and Riches, when they sleep and Aaron comes in sometimes. But, you know, these people all are in a community where they are all going to each other's camps and kind of moving around and stuff. So it could have been anybody put that in there. So the only evidence we got was we found the shovel that Feathers had described, because when Feathers said that Rich walked away after the axe and trying to make her lick it, and then he grabbed a shovel and walked back towards that direction where he last seen Aaron and him walking. The way she described that shovel was the handle was broke and they got a tree branch and whittled it down and secured it to the end of the shovel. So it was really good description of that. We got that out of the camp. The picture of Aaron Feathers had some markings on some calendars and stuff that she'd written, which led us to a rough estimate of the date of the last time she saw Aaron. So Aaron's body was discovered on March 26, 2021. The other murder was February 26, 2021.
You're talking about the guy who got shot in the head 200 yards from where Aaron was buried.
Yes. And during that time, all these people had been contacted during that first murder. So on her calendar, Feathers used the date to reference as she remembers that murder, the first one. She remembers the police in her camp. And she said the last time I saw Aaron was the Tuesday before that murder of when you guys came into my camp, which means that we're investigating that murder, that first one, the guy shot in his head, and we walk down to Feather's camp and we're asking questions about that with Aaron just been buried a few days prior and we had no idea. So after we get done with the warrant at the camp, we had Detective Baglietto. He was a newer detective. Baglietto came up to detectives and that guy can interview. That's his niche, man. That's his calling. Like the way he talks to people, the way he treats people, it's phenomenal. So my thought with this was Rich is going to be completely out of control still. He's in jail. We need to go get his buckle swab for DNA for comparisons to evidence on the crime scene. And it's probably going to be a handful to get him to open his mouth to swab. I didn't know if Detective Baglietto had done any DNA swabs before or anything. So I was like, hey, run with me. We'll go do this.
Training opportunity.
Yes.
Brandon, when you see Rich, do you bring up the Bible that survived the burn barrel?
Yeah, I wanted Rich to see the Bible. I took a lot of pictures of that Bible. I thought that was just truly incredible. So we get to the jail, me and Detective Baglietto do, and I tell the deputies, hey, I got to talk to Rich. And they start laughing and they're like, yeah, that guy's out of control. He's on suicide watch. He's hostile. He's violent. He's crazy. Good luck. We walk in there and we hear him coming down the hallway, getting escorted by deputies, yelling and grunting and growling and hissing all the stuff, right?
Rich being Rich.
Yeah. So he comes in and he sits down and the angriest look on his face. And I said, hey, Rich, we just did a search warrant on your camp. And he yells out, it's not my fucking camp, you know, just screaming. And set his feathers camp. And I said, okay, you got that burn barrel there? And he's like, oh, you know, just yelling. Everything is so aggressive with him. And I said, check out what we found. And I just show him the picture of the Bible. And Rich looks at it for a few minutes and he goes, I put that Bible in the fire. And I said, well, why did you do that? He goes, because it needed to burn. And like, this is how he's talking. He's just like yelling. And after he said it needed to burn, he sits back and he's sitting there for a second. And I almost see this like peace come over him. And like, he's starting to calm down. His shoulders are relaxing. In a quieter voice, he goes, can I see that again? And I said, yeah. So I show him the picture and he's holding my phone and he's looking at it for quite a while. And he goes, that's pretty cool. And now he's talking just like that. I said, I thought that was cool too, man. He goes, it's not a miracle though. And he hands me back my phone. Oh, okay. So we start talking. Now he is calm. He wasn't acting like this the day before. He wasn't acting like that when he walked in. I don't know what was going on in his head and his mind, but whatever it was, Rich had calmed down and was acting completely normal.
Brandon, so Rich says, I put that Bible in the burn barrel and it was supposed to burn. Does he offer any explanation as to why it didn't, even though he doesn't consider it a miracle?
No. He didn't offer any explanation. At that point, I'm just feeling him out, thinking we got to move into this DNA thing quick because he's going to get riled back up and then we'll be holding him down trying to get his DNA, right? And I said, hey, we got DNA that we got to do. We're just going to swab the inside of your cheek. You just need to open your mouth. Rich said, what about sex crimes? Isn't that the only thing DNA is used for is in sex crimes? And I said, well, no, we use them for burglaries and stolen cars. Assaults, DNA can be used on everything. I start explaining the aggressive handling, touch DNA, you know, and stuff. And he goes, well, why do you need my DNA on that? And I said, well, because we got a tarp that was wrapped around Aaron's body. And we're going to compare your DNA to the DNA on the tarp to see if your DNA is on there. And he said, oh yeah, my DNA is on that tarp. And I said, well, why is your DNA on the tarp? And Rich tells me that the tarp was in his camp and he had moved that thing all around and whoever killed him must have dragged his tarp over there and put his body around it.
So Rich is saying whoever killed Aaron handled the tarp and it wasn't me.
Absolutely. And that's where I'm talking about, where you could see a level of intelligence here where he's quickly coming up with an excuse, putting his DNA, admitting it's there, but this is how it got there without owning any guilt to it, you know? So I said, well, what about his clothing? Is your DNA going to be on Aaron's body? And he goes, oh, absolutely. And I said, well, Rich, why is your DNA going to be on Aaron's body? Rich tells me that he is an MMA trainer. And he's training Aaron how to be an MMA fighter, and they box every day. You know, he's blocking his hands and he's grabbing his shirt, you know, and they're wrestling and all stuff. And I said, okay, well, Rich, is your DNA going to be on his shoes? And he said, oh, absolutely. And I said, well, why is your DNA going to be on his shoes? He goes, kickboxing, I block his shoes. And I've probably worn his shoes. Rich has like a 14 size shoe, 12 shoe or whatever. Aaron's got like a size 8, you know, so we talk about that. And he's like, okay, yeah, I didn't wear a shoe. So that opened the door now. We're talking, he's calm, And I'm like, well, let's put aside this DNA and start talking about this case while he's still talking. So I started asking about how long he's been at the camp for with Feathers. And some of the things he tells me, Rich says that he ended up having a suicide attempt where he tried killing himself. And he believes he died because he saw God and saw the formation of the earth, and he saw the formation of space and time and all this stuff. And he's going on and on about this vision that he had and kept referring to as vision. And he said that God touched his forehead with a white mark and placed a white mark on his forehead. And God explained to him that Lucifer had interjected his way into the human race, and by doing that has become a brother to the human race. And God has instructed Rich to get to know his brother, Lucifer, because they are kin. That's what he said. So he said what that white mark did is it gave him wings to fly in heaven and legs to walk through hell, because he can do whatever he needs to do that is evil in order to know Lucifer better, and God won't judge him for the evil acts he takes when he gets to know Lucifer. So that's his suicide attempt, right?
How did Rich try to kill himself?
Hanging.
Okay. And he wasn't successful, but when he was in the throes of hanging himself, he had all these epiphanies, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Hey, it's Yardley.
And Dan.
And Dave.
I know, we know. We're interrupting your episode. Don't panic. We hate that too.
But it's for a good reason. If you're deep in our back catalog, listening to older episodes, you sound like one of our super fans.
Which means you might want to take things a step further and join our super fam.
Because super fam members get every new episode of Small Town Dicks early and ad-free.
Plus, bonus content every single week, all year round, even between seasons.
Think deeper dives into the topics we touch on in the show. Extra cases.
It's basically like hanging out with us between episodes and between seasons. Also, it is the best way to support our team behind the scenes so we can keep bringing you the stories that you love.
And yes, there's a super fam community. And yes, there are enamel pins and tote bags.
That's right. We've got you covered.
Super fam, the tote bags, they're so cute. If you're ready to go deeper with Small Town Dicks, all you have to do is visit smalltowndicks.com/superfam. That's SUPERFAM. We can't wait to see you there. Hey, it's Yardley.
And Dan.
And Dave.
I know, we know. We're interrupting your episode. Don't panic. We hate that too.
But it's for a good reason. If you're deep in our back catalog, listening to older episodes, you sound like one of our super fans.
Which means you might want to take things a step further and join our super fam.
Because super fam members get every new episode of Small Town Dicks early and ad-free.
Plus, bonus content every single week, all year round, even between seasons.
Think deeper dives into the topics we touch on in the show. Extra cases.
It's basically like hanging out with us between episodes and between seasons. Also, it is the best way to support our team behind the scenes so we can keep bringing you the stories that you love.
And yes, there's a super fam community. And yes, there are enamel pins and tote bags.
That's right. We've got you covered.
Super fam, the tote bags, they're so cute. If you're ready to go deeper with Small Town Dicks, all you have to do is visit smalltowndicks.com/superfam. That's SUPERFAM. We can't wait to see you there. So, Rich, there are a lot of ducks in the bucket here.
Yes.
So, Rich is in this interview. He's calm now. You've given up getting DNA for the moment because you want to talk about this case. He's telling you he tried to kill himself, had this epiphany about Lucifer, but God has instructed Rich to get to know Lucifer and then take care of whatever business needs to be taken care of. God will bless those evil acts and still let Rich into heaven when the time comes. In the meantime, he meets his girlfriend, Feathers.
Yeah, so right after his vision, he says within a few days, he meets Feathers. and she introduces him into Wicca and witchcraft, and he's referred to as her pet, and she has a coven of four other men, and Aaron is in this coven, and it's like a sex coven, you know, where they're kind of like her slaves and they have to do what she says. So Rich starts dating Feathers and moves into her camp. Then he goes off on this whole very explicit description of his sex life and his addiction to sex and how he's an infomaniac. He cannot sleep without having sex first. He will stay up and get insomnia until he has sex. And in very explicit craziness, talks about his sex life with Feathers and how it's the most amazing thing that he's ever experienced on this planet. Feathers will lead him into these seances, and it's to open up the spirit world so he can communicate with Lucifer and his spirits. And during these seances, Rich starts speaking in tongues and he starts dancing uncontrollably. And Satan doesn't have a voice that specifically talks to him that he hears, but he sees these visions and these flashes of pictures in his mind. And then he carries out these visions that he gets, and that allows Satan's voice to be heard by his actions. While he's doing this stuff, Feathers is drawing pictures, you know, and like communicating through the spirits through pictures. And then after the seance, they commence it with sexual activity. And that's what makes it phenomenal, is these seances, these visions, that's carrying out this will, he's dealing with these spirits, and then these sex acts. Again, he is very angry towards any homosexual activity, very hateful towards that. According to him, Feathers enjoys a lot of men and wants sexual contact at the same time with men. And he's not about that. He will not do that.
So Rich won't have any group sex.
Right. But what he did do and got used to is having Aaron and a couple other guys watch while he has sexual intercourse with Feathers. And Rich told me that he got really mad at Aaron because Aaron had video recorded him during this, having the sexual contact, and it made him really mad at Aaron for that. So he starts kind of having a little falling out with Aaron over that. Rich tells me a couple days later, he goes to sleep and he wakes up and he's wearing different pants than he had on when he went to bed. And he gets up and he's like, "Where's my pants?" And Aaron points to the pair of pants that are laying on the ground that are covered in shit. And he says, "You shit yourself last night really bad in your sleep. And I don't want you laying shit. So I pulled your pants off and put on new pants." And Rich becomes very angry about this because he believes that Aaron might have done something sexual to him while he was sleeping. So Rich says he's down in the creek inspecting areas of his body and seeing if things hurt. And, you know, he's just really, really angry at this and believes that Aaron is trying to do sexual things with him, because leading up to that, Aaron was really open to the idea of having sex with Rich and Feathers. So there's kind of the motive that we're starting to get and kind of the relationship between him and Aaron and why he's getting upset with him. So Rich tells me this continues with these seances and all these different things for several months and different activities going on with them. And during one seance, during his dancing and speaking in tongues, he sees Aaron's face in a vision. And then he sees this other guy, Ron, his face. And then he begins seeing sexual images with him and Aaron and Ron. And he says it freaks him out. He's like, "I can't have this," right?
So Rich sees images with Rich, Ron, and Aaron having sex, and he's pretty disturbed by that.
Correct. And so then after that seance, he comes out of it, and Feathers is drawing these sexual pictures with men, just men involved. So Rich, he's like, "I have to have sex with these guys. Like, I have to do this." And then he has another vision of death and murder, and he begins believing that Satan or Lucifer has given him an option, that he either has to kill Ron or Aaron or have sex with them. And once this is completed, Satan or Lucifer will dwell in his body for a short time until the end of time.
So it's grab one more soul.
Yes.
And Lucifer is going to inhabit Rich's body.
Correct. So Rich is fighting these feelings. He's fighting these emotions with this vision. And Feathers begins telling Rich, "I really want you to have sex with me while a man is having sex with you." And this is all of Feathers' requests. Her drawing is confirming the vision that he had from Satan. Like, this is real. I have to do this.
And this is all during this interview where Rich comes in at 100 miles an hour, but he calms down after this Bible photo. And now he's just delivering this to you, just straight-faced and calm.
Yes. And in sequential order, you know, when you interview these suspects and they begin right from the beginning and they go all the way to the end, and you get done and you're like, I really don't have any questions, versus the other people that you're like, whoa, whoa, back up, let's take this, and you got to guide them through the interview.
Right, you skip the whole crime part.
Yeah, I mean, he is just, this is my life, this is who I am, this is what I believe, and this is a several hour long interview. So Rich stops having sex. He's getting angry because of that, but this is too much stress and pressure because Rich doesn't want to kill people, but Rich doesn't want to have sex with men. And so he gets an idea. Rich can talk to Aaron and make him leave the area, and then he doesn't have to kill him and he doesn't have to have sex with him. So Rich will just push him out of the area, right? So Rich tells me that they are standing in front of their camp, and Rich says, Aaron, I need to talk to you. Let's go for a walk. And Rich tells me they walk right to the gravesite, right where we uncovered Aaron. Rich is trying to explain to Aaron, you need to leave. You can't stay here anymore. You have to go somewhere else. You don't know the forces that are happening, you know, all this satanic stuff that's going on. And he's trying not to let him know the vision, but he's trying to explain to him, Aaron, you need to leave, right? And Aaron doesn't understand. He's like, what are you talking about? Rich is trying to make him understand. And Aaron's response is, you pussy, because he wants to have sex with Rich. And Rich says, this made me so angry. As he's telling this, he's getting more and more emotionally involved, and he's getting louder, and he starts yelling out, he called me a pussy. Well, who's the pussy now? And I said, why did that make you so mad? Rich tells me, I'm trying to make Aaron live. I'm trying to save his life. And he calls me a pussy? Like, that ain't happening. You know, he gets angry about that. So Rich tells me, once that happened, he turned around and walked away, and Aaron walked away, and Rich went back to the camp, and he never saw Aaron again.
Did Aaron fall?
No, they had no physical contact, and there's no fighting, no nothing. They just went their separate ways after that.
And mind you, Aaron's deaf in one ear, partially deaf in the other. He's blind in one eye, and he's a lip reader, and it's dark, and you're in the middle of the woods. And Aaron is hearing this story from Rich that is completely absurd. Of course he doesn't understand.
But this is, again, according to Rich.
Yeah, this is Rich's side of the story, and we all know there's two sides to every story, right?
Yeah, and I'm very skeptical that Aaron was told this story that night. I mean, you take a look at what was done to Aaron. I mean, he's got extensive facial fractures. His hyoid bone is fractured. That indicates manual strangulation. He's got the hole in the back of the head, probably from the axe. And now Rich has had a month plus a few days to try to justify killing Aaron. In his mind, he's got this association with this deity, Lucifer, which supersedes anything on earth, right? So he's now coming up with his own justification on why he killed Aaron. I bet that they had some sort of argument and Rich went off on Aaron, and now he's linking the excuse up to Lucifer.
That's why I was like, you know, this is all according to Rich. I've got to explain away why there's a dead guy where I last saw him.
And maybe get off on being crazy.
Yeah. He's trying to cover his tracks.
So where we get into this is we sit in the interview for a while. You expect me to believe Aaron just walked away. Rich, come on. He denies. So I asked Rich, well, what'd you do when you walked away? What's the first thing you did? And he said, he goes back to his camp and he has the most amazing sex with feathers. And I asked him what was so amazing about it. And he said, well, I used an axe handle in the sexual act with feathers.
Oh my gosh.
Which is interesting because you have feathers. Tells me Rich came back with a bloody axe and was trying to make me lick the blood off the axe. And he talked to Rich and he said, no, we had sex with the axe.
Brandon, is there any indication that Rich wanting feathers to lick the blood off the axe has to do with some sort of satanic ritual, or is he just a fucking weirdo?
Probably a little bit of both. You know, it's really evil, disturbing, dark behavior, you know? So as he's telling me about this axe handle, he starts talking about how Rich and Feathers also began licking knives. And that kind of goes in hand with what Feathers was talking about, licking the axe. And then Rich tells me, we even used the knives to X out Satan from my heart. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, we carved an X on my chest. I said, can I see that? And he goes, yeah. And he pulls it up and he's got, you know, it's still healing up because it was about a month ago, but he's got an X carved into his chest where his heart is, like over his heart. And I said, why did you do that? And Rich calms way down and almost gets sad. Like the first time I've ever seen not an aggressive, crazy behavior from, you know, even when he was peaceful, he was still kind of aggressive in the way he talks. He got like really soft spoken and said, Lucifer deceived me. And he goes on to this whole statement about how immediately after that sex act, he felt no connection to Lucifer, no connection to these evil spirits. They tried other seances. He wasn't getting anything. And he didn't want Lucifer to enter his heart because he was deceived and Lucifer was not who he thought it was. So he wanted to X out his heart to keep Lucifer out. So, you know, you get these weird tangents of Rich. Like, is he just saying this stuff to cover his tracks and be crazy? But he's also got an X carved on his chest.
And it's a mile marker for the case. When that X went in was right after you did this act and felt betrayed by Lucifer. Like, now we can time it.
Yeah. So while Rich was in a saddened state and deceived and really calm, Baglietto, man, this question was awesome because it opened up into a great statement. Detective Baglietto asked Rich, can someone be justified if they kill someone? And Rich said, yeah, absolutely. If I saw a woman being raped, I would murder that person. And I'll tell you exactly how I'd do it. I'm an anaconda. I would wrap around their throat and choke the life out of them if I were to kill them. I would break their neck. I'm a snake. I would coil up and I would strangle them to death.
Wow.
Well, that matches the injuries we have on Aaron's body. And so we go back to, okay, you didn't walk away, man. You strangled him. Aaron's got a broken neck. Aaron's got a broken hyoid bone. Rich said, nope, I did not. I walked away. And he never admitted to killing Aaron. At that point, you know, when you hit the wall where you get pretty much all the information you're going to get out of somebody and there's no sense in just getting that final piece, I go back to the DNA and I said, hey, Rich, I got to get the swab. We're going to get out of here, but I got to do the swab now. And he said, okay. While I'm doing that, Rich said, quote, Aaron did something where he sprayed something on my toes and put tape on it. So if my prints are on his dick, I didn't knowingly in any way touch that. That was placed there.
I don't get it.
That's just such an odd statement. And I speculate if Rich did have sex with Aaron and then couldn't look himself in the mirror over it. And that ultimately led up to Aaron's demise. And this is something we'll never know.
This is coming on the heels of Baglietto's question and then you going to the DNA and now Rich going, well, shit, they might find my DNA on Aaron's penis. I have to have an explanation for that.
Yep. So we got the swab and we charged Rich with murder and abuse of a corpse.
Paul, you've investigated cases that had satanic bent to them. What do you make of all this?
Well, during the 1990s, that was when I first started rolling out onto crime scenes. You know, this was the satanic panic time. We had an occult expert within the department. And if there was anything that appeared, you know, like as what Brandon is saying, in this case, there's a pentagram that's at the scene. Immediately, people are starting to think, you know, the crime was committed because of occult activity. And the reality is that's very, very rare in terms of why these crimes were committed. In this case, in my mind, Rich has this mindset, you know, with Lucifer and his visions. But I think committing the crime, it comes down to the fundamental motives that we always see in cases involving homicide. Rich had to kill Aaron, either whether there was a disagreement or it was because of this concern of this homosexual act that Rich and Aaron had. Now he's getting rid of Aaron, and then he goes and says he has most amazing sex with Feather and wants her to lick the blood off of the axe. In my mind, I'm hearing this, and I find that very interesting. It doesn't match up with this occult vision. It almost is, in a way, Rich got sexually stimulated by the act of homicide on Aaron and went and had amazing sex with Feathers. That's how I'm hearing this.
Yeah. So going down on the prosecution side, you know, these things take a year and a half, 2 years later to finally get a disposition on the case, you know, and get a conviction or whatever. So what happens is 6-8 months go by. And one of my biggest worries is being able to find all of our witnesses, because we had like 25 homeless witnesses. Every one of them needed to come and testify because they all had a little piece of the puzzle, right? One, fentanyl's out of control and people are ODing all the time on it. And I'm like, are we going to have in 2 years living witnesses on this? The other one is, are we going to be able to find them? And what is their mental health going to be at that point in 2 years? So we find out through a prosecution that the defense is looking at the same things we're looking at and say, no, we're going to take this. You won't be able to find anybody. So I put out a BOLO, be on lookout, to patrol division, to our livability division, and all of our detectives. And we spent a week with all their pictures, last known camps, you know, and all we asked on the BOLO was, if you find this person, get a picture with them and email me the picture and the date and the place he had contact. So we spent a week and we contacted every one of them, found every one of them and got pictures with them, emailed them to the DA, said, hey, this took us like 4 days.
And that's to show the defense, like, hey, you guys thought this was going to be an issue. It is not. We've got all these witnesses still.
Exactly. So what we did is we don't have 30 beds in the jail to put these people on material witness holds to get them cleaned up, get them in a sober state, you know, get them in a mental good spot where they can come in and testify and present well on a trial. And we all know you throw the facts to the jury. You may get a jury pool where you have that one person that says, I cannot find anybody guilty in my conscience, so I'm just going to say not guilty. Or the jurors look at it and say, all your witnesses are uncredible. They're all saying this stuff, all this stuff about Satan and weird stuff, you know, because what we lacked was physical DNA from Rich on Aaron and on the tarp. Never found it. The weather, the elements had washed all that evidence away over time, you know. So we're really running this case on statements, was what it came down to. We didn't have the axe. We didn't have the axe head. And so these were challenging. And we know that Rich killed Aaron, but how are you going to prove that to a juror? You know, and I think we still probably could have gotten a guilty verdict on it. But jurors say, well, they didn't get any DNA. You know, it wasn't on video, you know, and they find these things to dismiss the case and find them not guilty. So we had a long talk with the prosecution and the victim's family, and everybody was in agreement. Let's offer a 15-year deal. And the biggest thing the family was worried about when we explained the challenges with prosecuting this is they said, we don't want Rich getting out. We'd rather have him do 10 years or 15 years rather than just walking away from this after what he did to our family. So they made the offer. Rich took it, and he's upstate for 15.
So Rich takes the deal probably because he's got his defense attorney saying the DA's office never gives deals when there's a murder case. This is your chance. You might as well take it.
Yeah.
And can we expect that Rich will serve every day of those 15 years, or will he get out on parole in 5?
It goes in accordance with the charge that he pled to. I don't think he pled to the murder charge. I think they did a different charge.
Like a manslaughter.
Yeah, man one or something.
Even with credit, I think he'd still serve 85% of that plus.
Yeah.
You still have that Bible?
So obviously the Bible's not in a search warrant. We didn't know we were going to find that. We photographed it. And my thought was, if this thing survived this, it's here for a reason. And I put it back in Feather's tent and left it there.
What a case, Brandon. My God. I just want you to know my Wednesday will never look like that ever. Brandon, that was amazing. Honestly, I have no words. Thank you so much for bringing that to us today and spending some time with us.
Thank you.
After our experience in the academy, I'm quite surprised that you solved anything.
Well, thank you. You know, it's all luck.
Really good job. Really challenging case. It's like herding cats sometimes when you're wrangling witnesses, and you guys did a great job.
Amazing case, Brandon.
Thank you.
Small Town Dicks was created by Detectives Dan and Dave. The podcast is produced by Jessica Halstead and me, Yardley Smith. Our senior editor is Soren Bajan, and our editors are Christina Bracamontes and Aaron Phelps. Our associate producers are The Real Nick Smitty and Aaron Gaynor. Gary Scott is our executive producer, and Logan Heftel is our production manager. Our books are cooked and cats wrangled by Ben Cornwell. And our social media maven is Monica Scott. It would make our day if you became a member of our small town fam by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at Small Town Dicks. We love hearing from you. Oh, our groovy theme song was composed by John Forrest. Also, if you'd like to support the making of this podcast, hop on over to patreon.com/smalltowndickspodcast. There, for a small subscription fee, you'll find exclusive content you can't get anywhere else. The transcripts of this podcast are thanks to SpeechDocs, and they can be found on our website, smalltowndicks.com. Thank you, SpeechDocs, for this wonderful service. Small Town Dicks is an Audio 99 production. Small Town fam, thanks for listening. nobody is better than you. Hey, it's Yardley.
And Dan.
And Dave.
I know, we know. We're interrupting your episode. Don't panic. We hate that too.
But it's for a good reason. If you're deep in our back catalog, listening to older episodes, you sound like one of our super fans.
Which means you might want to take things a step further and join our super fam.
Because super fam members get every new episode of Small Town Dicks early and ad-free.
Plus, bonus content every single week, all year round, even between seasons.
Think deeper dives into the topics we touch on in the show. Extra cases.
It's basically like hanging out with us between episodes and between seasons. Also, it is the best way to support our team behind the scenes so we can keep bringing you the stories that you love.
And yes, there's a super fam community. And yes, there are enamel pins and tote bags.
That's right. We've got you covered.
Super fam, the tote bags, they're so cute. If you're ready to go deeper with Small Town Dicks, all you have to do is visit smalltowndicks.com/superfam. That's S-U-P-E-R-F-A-M. We can't wait to see you there.